watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we continue our lecture series, The USA, Where We Are, Where We're Going, with economist Doug Dowd. This time, looking at the financial industry and its role in shaping economic and social realities. There's a lot of information in the program, and you may want to tape this so you can listen to it a few times. If you're not able to do it, all shows are archived on our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Doug Dowd is the author of many books on economics and politics, and he has a long career as an activist as well as a scholar. The audio you're hearing is from a free class for the public he gives each year in San Francisco. Professor Doug Dowd.
What I'm going to talk about tonight is a continuation of that part of the new book, if it is a new book, on the what I call the realities of the U.S. economy. And what I'm trying to do in this book, as I think those of you who have been coming regularly know, is indicate how each of the various dimensions of the United States and therefore of the world economy are in one kind of real trouble or another. I'm going to try to finish up the realities, the economic realities this evening. We did it last time. It started it last time. And the next time we'll be talking about what I call social policy, health, education, welfare, the difficulties we're having with that, and how it's all getting worse. One is almost tempted to say it is being made to become worse by the present administration. From that, I'll go on. I'll either take one or two meetings with that, and then we'll go on to discussing the military situation of the United States, and then on to the environment, then on to politics. And one of the things that I'm not going to be discussing tonight, I should say two of the things I'm not going to be discussing, which are closely related. One is inequality. The other is jobs. I will be taking them up later. The jobs will be taken up under social policy. And inequality I'm going to take up in the last chapter. I almost began this whole book with that because for me, and I think for anyone who's, shall we say, decent, or to put that differently, left of center, and I think if one is decent, one is left of center. You can't hang around on the right very long if you're decent. Anyone who's decent, what should be most striking about the system under which we live and have lived our predecessors for the last couple hundred years, namely capitalism. Capitalism depends upon inequality. And I'm not taking it up now under the realities of the economy because inequality is not just an economic thing. It's everything. It's social, it's political, it's cultural, it's everything. And it's the worst of all the sins, and the most necessary of all the sins of capitalism. So I'm going to be giving a very short shrift compared with what I think it should be. If I ever write another book after this one, and I'm not sure I will, I don't mean I can't, I mean I'm getting so pissed off with publishers I can hardly put pen to paper without thinking this is hopeless, stupid. They say, okay, we publish it, and then they throw it in the toilet and use it for toilet paper. The publishers do. In any case, if I ever were to write another book, it would be entirely about inequality. That's how important it is to me and to you, whether you make it explicit in yourself or not. So what I'm going to do this evening is finish up with what I've begun with the economy. What I've been doing the past meeting was discussing mostly, basically, globalization. And tonight I'm going to talk about financialization. It's extremely important to be conscious of that, and debt, and fragility, the associated fragility of it all. And I'm not going to be able to do it properly here in a couple of hours. As most of you know in this room, there is a website for these classes, and on the website, which is www.dougdowd.org, not .com. On the website, there are all kinds of articles and commentaries and so on and so on. And also one book of mine, which was published last year, called Broken Promises of America, which is an encyclopedia. And we're all supposed to laugh when I say that. It's a two-volume encyclopedia. From that book, there are about 25 excerpts on the website. Financialization, monetarism, globalization, and so on and so on. I expect those of you who have a computer and who want to find out more about what I'm talking about this evening, or other evenings, because there are things on health care, social security, racism, and so on up on the website. You go to the website, and what you really ought to do, and one of the purposes of these classes is to encourage you to do it, is read more. There are all kinds of references in all the things that I write, as well as what I say. And the way things are going in the world today, most especially in the United States today, you have an obligation to yourself and to your fellow human beings to know as much as you can know. Go to work on about getting that changed. And you've got to know more than you know. I don't care who you are, myself included, of course. We've got to know more than we know. We've got to have, as I use this phrase many times, it's a terribly important phrase, we've got to have the courage of our convictions. We all know that this society stinks, but if you're going to be political about it, and we must be political about it, that means you're going to be trying to convey that to other human beings in this society. And they've been socialized to think this society is a bed of roses. Or if it isn't, it's their own fault, etc., etc., etc. So you've got to know as much, you've got to understand, you've got to work as much as you can. Stop watching the goddamn tube. Work as much as you can to understand so that you can be sure that what you're angry about needs to be angry about, and so on and so on and so on. So what I'm doing in these classes is, in effect, trying to say, let's walk down this path and you keep going. Okay, so let me turn to financialization now. One of the many things that's wrong with economics, and the list starts up there and goes down through the basement, is that you could take a course, you could take a major in economics at Berkeley, Stanford, the best schools, the worst schools. And unless you had a screwball for a professor, somebody like myself, for example, what I'm going to be talking about now, you would never even be discussed in your classes. That is to say, the basic nature of what's going on in the economy now, you would never, I think, hear an economist say in your classes that financialization, that finance, dominates the entire economy now. Not industry, certainly not manufacturing. Financialization, not the services, except insofar as the services include the financial community, if you can call it a community. So what I'm going to be talking about now should be something that's common knowledge amongst people who study economics, but it isn't. Nothing of what's important about the economy is common knowledge in the economics profession, except for screwballs, or people who are, like Paul Krugman, on their way to becoming screwballs. That finance does dominate the economy, that is to say that finance dominates industry, manufacturing, mining, agriculture, retail, etc., 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 whatever's left, trade, global trade, and so on. That finance does is at the basis of two very, very worrisome processes. One has to do with the steady weakening of our economies and the world economy's vitality, and its replacement, secondly, by increasing fragility at home and abroad. This is, so to speak, the essential outcome, the essential collateral damage of financialization. Because, as I will try to make very clear to you this evening, or at least get a start on it, when we say that financialization is dominating, we're saying something else. We're saying that speculation is dominating. We're saying that the whole world economy, no matter what the intention of the people who have power in Washington or in General Electric or General Motors or General whatever it is, whatever their intentions, the way in which they now function necessarily means that what they have done is to transform our economy and the world economy into a gambling casino in which those who are the principal actors, the prime movers, not only don't know, they don't care about anything except their daily transactions and their own personal gain from it. That's what happens in a gambling casino. And those who are functioning in a gambling casino always work within a narrow framework. It's like a racehorse going down the track with blinders on them. Look at this, see that, everything else, fuck it. So that's what I'm going to talk about. I quote to you from the annual economic report of the President of the United States. Of course, he can't even read it, let alone write it. In 1949, this is a quote from the economic report, incidentally, which you can get from the USGPO in San Francisco. And although the economic report of the president is always hot air, what they say is always political, in the back 100 pages or so are all statistics, you understand? All kinds of statistics, which accumulated going back tens of years, dozens of years, 100 years, depending upon the item. It's a very useful, so to speak, statistical dictionary. In 1949, corporate profits, I want you to hear the word profits, corporate profits of non-financial companies, automobile companies and so on, were 10 times higher than interest, which is the financial return boiled down, than the main, which was then, in 1949, the main revenue of financial companies. In 1959, 10 years later, the ratio was 5-1, not 10-1. In 1969, the ratio had dropped to 2.5-1. By 1979, corporate profits were 1/4 of interest, not equal to interest. Since 1989, corporate profits have always been less than interest. You understand we're talking about all the profits of all the corporations when measured against the incomes of financial companies, okay? Banks, essentially. That's an extraordinary revolution, or I should say transformation. So how come that happened? How did that happen? It didn't happen because of ill will, goodwill, or anything like that. It happened because of a whole set of overlapping, interacting developments that had to do with what the world economy was becoming after World War II, led by the most capitalistic of all societies in history. Non-financial companies themselves, for one thing, became more and more financialized. For example, one of the things that happened going back to the 1920s, and the 20s is essentially when the modern world, what we call our world modern, began to evolve. The 20s was, and incidentally, the policies pursued by the White House today are the policies of the 1920s, brought back to life and given machine guns to work with instead of pop guns. In the 1920s, this is when big business really began to be giant business. And the big firms, General Electric and General Motors, in the lead, in the 20s, both of them began to become financial companies in addition to becoming industrial companies. Why? Because they could make money from it. They could make greater sales from it, but also something else. They could also integrate their financial policies for the consumer with the product itself. And they could compete with each other in safer ways by competing in terms of interest rates than ever lowering their prices. There's no price competition. There hasn't been for 60 years in the automobile industry. The only competition they engage themselves in is, you see it signs all the time now because the car companies are all in trouble in this country. They have you come in, you can get this car for $5,000 less. Not the price less, but in terms of how you're going to pay for it. You understand? And when they want to, they can always begin to alleviate that, get rid of it, and so on. But you can't do that if you cut prices. Okay? If you cut prices, that stays down. And every company in the past has had that experience. In the past, before companies wised up about how to totally evade price competition and still compete. They compete by financial competition now because it's reversible. Price competition is not reversible. You know? So that was one of the things that happened. In addition, as globalization, the modern post-World War II globalization began to take hold, they didn't begin to call it that until the 70s and 80s, but as the United States began to globalize, with its IMF and World Bank and Marshall Plan and this, that, and the other thing, all the European things that we did, all the regional groups that we set up and so on, and they were all set up by us. As we began to do that, then it also was true that not only were companies merging more and more and more and more, it was also true that the importance of money in the economy came to be also more and more important. The kinds of things that are now in great trouble, pension funds, for example, didn't even exist before World War II. You understand? Here and there, there was a big company that might have had, like, for example, that candy company back east. I don't. It doesn't matter.
Hershey.
Hershey began a long time ago to do this kind of a thing, but it wasn't until unions began to become meaningful in terms of power, and until after World War II, that you began to get anything like the kinds of things you have now, which are all kinds of equity funds and pension funds and so on and so on and so on. As each of these things took hold, it meant that the banking community was becoming more and more involved in the real community, and the real community became more and more financialized as a means of making money. So that it now is all very difficult to draw the line, to find the line between finance and production, between finance and agriculture, between finance and anything. The growth of international trade, also meant that big business became, not some of it as always, but all of it, or else it wasn't big, became involved in international transactions, and you go from giant corporation to multinational corporation to transnational corporations. TNCs they're called now. And these institutions, these companies, are intrinsically involved in financial deals every minute of every day. They're always buying and selling something with currencies here, there, and elsewhere. You understand? They're always involved in this kind of thing, more and more and more. And as financialization began to take hold, and as incomes went up on the top and in the middle, it also became true that instead of there being people involved in financial markets who were pros, you began to get the amateurs coming in, as they did in the 20s, incidentally, in relatively small quantities, up at the top 15%. Now it goes down to the bottom, through the top 40% in one way or another. You have all kinds of foolish people thinking they too can become rich through one kind of financial investment or not, or another. One kind of speculation, whether they know it or not, or another. And now what you have, incidentally, on the top of the scale, is you have the hedge fund as the par excellence kind of a thing. Until very recently, you couldn't get involved in a hedge fund as a participant unless you had at least $1 million to stick into it. Now, my friends, there are over 9,000 hedge funds. Okay? And as of a couple of years ago, in them were $1 trillion. Now, a trillion is a word that you don't even know what I'm talking about. It's 1,000 billion. And 1 billion is too much to think about. 1 billion is 1,000 million. 1 million is 1,000,000. 1,000 is 1,000 ones. When you talk about a trillion, you talk about something that is unthinkable. The United States owes $3 trillion to the rest of the world, net. Not net, we owe $7 trillion to the rest of the world. That is to say, we have investments where if we sold all of our investments off, we'd only owe $3 trillion. That's all. Only three. So, was probably the very first step in financialization long ago, turn of the century, that is say, beginning of the 20th century, was when what we today call mergers and acquisitions got started on a giant scale rather than the small scale they had been in the 1880s, 1890s. It all really started on the giant scale with the framing, with the coming into being of the United States Steel Corporation, done by, naturally, a financial company, J.P. Morgan. And now, mergers and acquisitions, as we began to call them after World War II, they used to be called combinations. Mergers and acquisitions keep multiplying, not just adding more and more, but multiplying, doubling, going up logarithmically. The 20s were seen as, my God. The 60s were seen, The 70s and the 80s, the 90s, it's just more and more and more and more and more all the time. And every one of those mergers and acquisitions involves the participation of a financial corporation. You understand? So this is another big, big, big deal, making for financialization. So what difference does it make? Well, it makes all kinds of differences, but here's one difference that Kevin Phillips pointed out already in 1994. And Kevin Phillips, as I've told you before, is a Republican conservative in the old-fashioned sense of the term conservative. Okay? He's not one of these wild, crazy pieces of apple pie. You thought I was going to say shit. I don't say that word anymore. This is from Kevin Phillips, writing almost more than 10 years ago. He's talking about power now. In the early 1970s, that's only 30 years ago, the financial sector was subordinate to Congress and the White House, and the total of financial trades conducted by American firms or American exchanges over a year, an entire year, was a dollar amount less than the gross national product, the total of all those trades. Wait till I get to the last sentence of this. By the 1990s, however, through a 24-hour-a-day cascade of electronic hedging and speculation, the financial sector had swollen to an annual volume of trading 30 or 40 times greater than GNP. You understand? From being less than. Each month, several dozen huge domestic financial firms and exchanges electronically trade a sum in currencies, futures, derivative instruments, stocks, and bonds that exceeds the entire annual gross national product of the United States. Each month. What is the entire gross national product of the United States?
$11 trillion.
It's $11 trillion. So globalization had the consequence, many consequences, but it had the consequence of, among other things, and what is finally going to be the blow to anything like stability in the world, was the financialization of the whole world economy. I'm going to talk about that now at some length, more than perhaps you want, but as I said a moment ago, when we think about financialization, in this world, in this capitalist world, what we're talking about is the domination of the economy by gamblers, speculators. Some of you know this, I've mentioned in other meetings. Going back 10 years or so, I think it was late 90s, this kid out in Singapore who was working for Baring Brothers brought Baring Brothers down, and one day he lost $1 billion. Because he guessed that the yen was going to do this instead of doing that, or he guessed it was going to do that instead of doing this. It doesn't matter which way he went. He guessed wrong. And Baring Brothers, which had been the principal financier of U.S. industrialization in the 19th century, went kapoop. It got bought up by somebody else, and now it's like a nothing. That was 10 years ago or so. I think it was 1997. Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, most of you have heard this before, but it's worth repeating over and over again. Another conservative, not a Republican because he was a Brit, but a very conservative guy, who was appalled at the notion of anything but a capitalist society, but also appalled by what was happening to capitalism, said this in his General Theory in 1936. This is only part of it, of course. Speculators, he said, may do no harm as bubbles on a steady stream of enterprise. But the position is serious when enterprise becomes a bubble on a whirlpool of speculation. When the capital development of a country becomes the byproduct of the activities of a casino, the job is likely to be ill done. That was Keynes. And when he was writing, he was talking about something like a little bush here or there. I don't mean... a little plant here or there. Now we're talking about a very thick jungle of speculation. It's just extraordinary what's going on. And as I'll try to make clear as the evening grunts itself on, the kind of stuff that's going on now, and not just in Wall Street, everywhere, is just really hair-raising. There's no way out of it except an explosion. So I mentioned there are many elements involved in bringing us to this stage. sitting at the center of it, but not the only thing by far, is debt. Because when you talk about debt, you're talking about the accumulation of financial instruments of one sort or another, and it's those financial instruments that are speculated in, you understand? So let's talk about debt for a minute. Absolutely extraordinary. Extraordinary, not just in numbers, which is a quantitative thing, but qualitatively. What it means, that is to say, what is it? What's happening to companies? What's happening to people? What's happening to countries that has allowed them, caused them, forced them, permitted them to accumulate mountains, Tibetan mountains of debt that cannot mean anything, but at some point, and only question is not will it, but when, at some point, extraordinary disaster. I'll begin with government debt. Governments have always gone into debt. Businesses have always gone into debt. Individuals have always gone into debt. Countries have always gone into debt. There's nothing new about debt. What's new is the why, the how, the who, the what. What are countries, what is this country going into debt for? This government, our government debt now is just rising at the rate of $500 billion a year, a little more than that. Speaking now as in terms of economics, I can say that would be okay if, great big if, depend upon what it's going into debt for and what it's doing along with that accumulation of debt. There's nothing good, bad, or indifferent about debt as such. It has to do with not just how much even. It has to do with how, why, and so on and so on and so on. And what's happening now is just absolutely extraordinarily not foolish and dangerous. It's obscene. The national debt of the United States now is over $10 trillion. That is to say, the federal government's debt. I'm not talking about anything but the federal government's debt. There's never been anything like it before in terms of either quantity or quality. The only thing that came close, as I think I mentioned last time, is during World War II, when the government had to all of a sudden pay for an extraordinarily rapid expansion of its military potential, and to bring into the military from 1942 to 1945, 16 million people were in the military, men and women, I almost said children. There was at least one child, my CO. That was up here. 16 million people. And to say nothing of what happened to the economy, it wasn't just that we produced a hell of a lot. It took the economy out of the worst depression it ever been into. It is not generally remembered or known that in 1941, when we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, there was still 10% unemployment in the United States. It isn't until you get into 42, 43, 44, 45 that we get to what was not only not unemployment, it was overemployment, where you had 1.5% unemployment, which is not enough. It's very inefficient. And what that employment did was to transform a lot of the society other than just jobs and money. It was the one period, the first period in our history, when all of a sudden women were doing jobs that women can't do, driving buses, working in factories, doing all kinds of work, white-collar work, blue-collar work, and so on. When people who weren't white were doing jobs that they had not been doing before. This was when there's this great migration out of the South, not just of blacks, but also of whites, going to where there were good jobs, and a great expansion of Southern industry itself, mostly for the military. Almost everything that was going on was for the military. There was also an enormous amount of savings going on. People were buying bonds out of patriotism or whatever, or because there were all kinds of ways of seeing to it that you would buy bonds. It was very difficult not to buy them if you didn't want to be very, very unpopular. It was when incomes all of a sudden went from rock bottom up to something really comfortable for probably two-thirds of the population. And it was all done by borrowing. Okay? Borrowing. Those bonds that people were buying were debts of the United States government, etc., 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 etc. So our deficit went sky high, the highest it's ever been. And then it went down again right after the war. But now, the deficit is higher in real terms than it was, that is to say, after adjusting for monetary changes, higher than it was in World War II. For what? So that the rich can get richer, or to put it differently, so that the rich don't have to pay any taxes, or can pay much lower taxes than what they had before. And so that the military can go on producing more and more military stuff, which I don't have to discuss with you, at least not now, if at all, as being absolutely stupid, not serving any purpose, even not even serving the purpose of Iraq. We're producing all kinds of crap that's very, very, very expensive for a handful of companies. Two companies for this, two companies for that, no competition whatsoever. The whole thing is, I mean, talk about ethics, talk about morality, talk about decency. What the United States government is doing with military expenditures now is just absolutely, I use the word again, obscene. Well, I think most of you know who Robert Rubin was. He was Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton. He's somebody I really was very angry with almost all the time because he's so conservative. Okay? And he's from the financial sector. He's from one Goldman Sachs or one of the big financial companies. Okay? So he has this long article in the New York Times editorial page. Attention, deficit disorder. He's not. I'm just going to quote you a couple of things in here about what he has to say. Now, here's Robert Rubin, Mr. Conservative from Wall Street, okay, who just was probably the single most influential people in bringing out the worst in Clinton, which is pretty easy to do, but nevertheless, he did it very well. He talks about Social Security here and the deficit in there for purposes of making another point, but I'll just read to you what he has to say about that just so to hammer down some of this nonsense that's going on about Social Security. Over the long term, over the longer term, he says Social Security has a 75-year estimated deficit of $4 trillion, 75 years over the long term. With the different components of Medicare, including its new prescription drug benefits, represent a fiscal problem altogether, all of those, of $20 trillion over the next 75 years. And he talks about the dangers of having that kind of deficit in terms of private investment and so on. It crowds out other kinds of investment because those bonds have to be issued, they have to be paid for, interest has to be paid for on them. You have any idea how much interest the government is paying every year? And it's going to maybe the top 5% of the population, almost all, over $300 billion of interest. Okay? Interest. Then he goes on to say this, and he brings us back to Social Security again. As Business Week, he's quoting Business Week, not exactly a lefty publication, said in a recent editorial, quote, "The deficit morass is due as much to a revenue shortfall as to excessive spending." Revenue shortfall means, as he points out, the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts are estimated to have a 75-year cost of $11 trillion. Okay? Three times the Social Security deficit, going to a handful of people, literally speaking. If the tax cuts for those earning above $200,000 were repealed and the inheritance tax as reformed, the 10-year projected deficit would be reduced by $1 trillion, almost 25%, and the 75-year reduction would be roughly $3.9 trillion instead of $20 trillion. if you just repealed the tax cuts. Okay? That's what's going on. I mean, what's going on is mass major criminality. But it isn't called that. It's called the ownership society, or some other nice word, or personal accounts as a proposition, and so on. It's something, and I started out this evening by saying, you must learn as much as you can so you can have the courage of your convictions. Most people in the United States don't know one damn thing about Social Security, except what they read in the papers. And the papers they read are not the New York Times. Or even the New York Times is not worthwhile, except once in a while when you get somebody like this popping off like this, and so on. I want to turn now to business debt. Now, there are two kinds of business debt. One is the debt of non-financial businesses, and the others of financial businesses. And they're worth separating. It used to be that non-financial corporations, that is to say corporations that were producing something for products, not banks and so on, borrowed, incurred debt because they were expanding or for ongoing purposes of buying raw materials and so on and so on. Short-term debt, long-term debt. It was a necessary, useful, and non-dangerous, economically speaking, non-dangerous proposition. Necessary for the economy. So it's gone. Debt has been part of our history. When I say our history, I mean modern history, since before the beginnings of capitalism. Began, as it happens, in Italy, in Genoa. But what debt has become is something which is, again, non-financial companies are becoming financial companies, for one thing. GE is what is called a non-financial company. It's one of the biggest financial institutions in the world. GM is a non-financial company, and so on, and so on. But what these non-financial companies are doing, or let me put it differently, what their CEOs are doing is to make their well-being depend to a critical extent on the speculation that these non-financial companies are doing in one realm or another of the speculative spectrum, whether it's in stocks and bonds at home or currencies or whatever. And I'll get back to that in a minute. As I said, you can look up a lot of this on the website. Let me just focus in on something that is, so to speak, in the news every day now. What non-financial companies have been doing in terms of investing their own financial assets in the market. General Motors, for example, is United Airlines. These companies both have pension funds. And those pension funds are presumably funds which accumulate over time as General Motors or whatever takes some of its revenues and puts it into these funds and puts those funds themselves, those funds become bonds or some other kind of secure financial investment that will bring some return, of course, and that's understandable. But that's not what they've been doing. What they've been doing is speculating in the market. In, among other things, derivatives, which are the most crazy things of all. Nobody even understands derivatives. You don't understand them. I don't understand them. The people who got Nobel Prize for writing about them didn't understand them. They were the people who were the advisors of LCTM, which went bankrupt, which was the principal derivative thing. And these companies, General Motors has admitted that its pension fund money has gone into speculation market and the market went down all of a sudden on them. Now, who would have ever thought that the market would go down? Now, we have, back in the 70s, before the counter-revolution had really become, so to speak, fulsome, as it did under Reagan, when the 60s were still, in some sense or another, institutionally still dominant, whether we speak of unions or Social Security or Medicare mentalities or whatever, back in the 1970s, the Congress passed a law creating an institution called the Pension Guarantee Fund or something of that, Pension Something Something Guarantee Fund, which is supposed to be the insurance company for the pension funds of private companies. So that if, by chance, a private company that had a pension fund failed, went bankrupt, there would be some payment coming from, not the total payment, but some payment coming from the Pension Guarantee Fund. Well, now the Pension Guarantee Fund has billions, tens of billion dollars of liabilities facing them in excess of their own assets. And Congress has been asked to increase their assets, to increase the assets of the pension, and Congress won't have anything to do with it. So now we have United Airlines, we have General Motors, we have coming around the corner a whole train full of companies who have been putting their monies into speculative funds of one sort or another. And what's happening is that they're going to just do what United Airlines is doing. They're going to say, sorry, get it out from the Pension Guarantee Fund, and within 2-3 years, there will be no fund at all. At the same time, the very same time, that Bush and a very high percentage of the people in Congress are saying, let's privatize, they don't say let's do that, let's privatize Social Security, so that people who get old, as they get old, they can have their money can grow, their own, the things that they have themselves chosen to invest in, so that they don't, they can own, they can control, and so on. And of course, the majority of people in the United States, by which I mean no less than 90%, doesn't know what the hell is going on when they invest their money in any, whatever they put their money into it. They don't know what's going on when they get U.S. bonds. They don't know. They certainly don't know what's going on when they go into anything else that's private. The United States developed Social Security. I'll be talking about this next time more. Much more. Developed Social Security as the last nation among major nations. We were the last to do it. Do you know what the first was, incidentally, and when?
Germany.
Germany, under Bismarck. And he knew what he was doing. He was trying to counter what was developing in Germany at that time, namely what became the left in Germany. We didn't do it for that reason. We did it because it was in the middle of a depression. The Roosevelt administration was under great pressure to begin to do something sane, decent, with respect to the misery, the actual and the potential misery of the majority of its population because of the Depression and because of the kinds of inability of people to do anything about their future if and when they got old or disabled. And when Social Security was put in 1935, it was a political act by the Roosevelt administration and a good one, except that it was put in at a time when there was no, so to speak, political base for it that had any understanding of what was involved. So it was, in some sense or another, privatized from the beginning. You understand? The Social Security thing is based upon payroll deductions. There's no reason in the world why it should be based on payroll deduction. People should get, if they're old and disabled, old and unable to live decently, they should be taken care of. Not in terms of how much they put in because of their incomes over time, because the people who are most likely to be needy when they retire are the people who have put very little into it, if you're doing payroll deductions, because the payroll deduction is a percentage of your income. You understand? When it was started, it was 1%. So the poorer you were, the less you'd have coming to you. The more needy you were, the less you'd get. Now it's not 1%. It was raised in the 70s and the 80s, and now it's up closer to 7%. But when they did this, first they started with a compromise, making a payroll deduction, which isn't what they do in Europe, incidentally, or Japan. We're unique, or Britain. You have to pay for it. You get what you pay for, right? You get what you pay for. But they put a limit on it. above a certain income, you don't pay anything at all. That is to say, the higher your income, the less you pay as a percentage of your income. Now it's 90,000. A year ago, it was 87. So going back to Reagan times, it was 50,000, something like that. There should be no limit whatsoever. And if there had never been a limit, if they had said Social Security means that everyone who's needy when he or she retires and or becomes disabled will receive an income from the United States government and or state and local governments taken together, which will allow that person to meet his or her basic needs for shelter, nutrition, health, and, if necessary, education. Does that sound like Stalinism to you? It does to an awful lot of people. Have the government supply that? And so on. And if you're rich, what do you get from the government? Taxes. High taxes. When this country started, when they put together the Constitution, the people who put it together, led by, in this particular case, Jefferson, argued that the tax policy of the United States should be decided in terms of one rule: ability to pay. The rich have a high ability to pay. The people who are in the middle have some ability to pay. The people who are poor don't have any ability to pay. Therefore, no taxes below what? Well, I would say, and we will get to this some other time, below the living wage, no taxes. Above the living wage, what do we mean by a living wage? There would be a minimum of $30,000 a year. The minimum wage that we have now gives you a total annual wage under the poverty level, and the poverty level itself is an understatement of what poverty is by comparison with any other country in the world, and so on. There's something really wrong here, you understand? So much for that. Non-financial corporations, I might say just in terms of one other thing about the CEOs, this is something that is, if anything, an understatement. This is from a little outfit called Multinational Monitor. Some of you may know it. It comes out every 2 months. Very nice little magazine. I think they probably sell it here. If that's my broker, tell him I'm busy. When Business Week started its annual compensation survey in 1950, the highest paid CEO was GM's Charles Wilson. He's the guy who said, "What's good for General Motors is good for America." He meant, "What's good for General Motors is good for Charlie Wilson." Everybody makes a mistake. At that time in 1950, Charlie took home 220 times as much as the average worker. In 2001, not 1950, but 50 years later, the pay champ was Oracle's Larry Ellison, who exercised some long-held options and pulled in, listen to this number, 28,193 times instead of 229 times, as much as the average worker. 28,000 times as the average worker he took in from selling his stock. He sold his stock. He wanted somebody else to have them. You know, he'd had them along. These are extreme cases, he says. But now the average CEO has an annual income, not taking into account stock options, just income, of over 400 times that of the average worker. Average worker means the median wage. Okay? There's something obscene about it. Pardon?
They use more expensive drugs than you do.
Besides, they aren't.
I might say that as far as the pension funds are concerned, this was in the Chronicle this past week, rumors unsettle Wall Street. Hedge funds add to investor worries. These are hedge funds being bought by pensions for Pennsylvania. Long simmering worries about the growing influence of hedge funds erupted Tuesday in a wave of nervous selling on world stock markets after talk that hedge funds had suffered large losses tied to the debt of General Motors. Tied to the debt of General Motors. In other words, the hedge funds were in General Motors stock, making very smart investments. Hedge funds are lightly regulated, that's an exaggeration, they're not regulated at all, investment tools, pools for the wealthy and institutions such as pensions, and so on, they go on, possible losses in hedge funds, and so on. Now, when people are in hedge funds, or when companies are into hedge funds, they know more than I do about how risky they are. You understand? I mean, I'm not an expert on hedge funds. But people who speculate in these things do read about hedge funds. So they know what they're doing, except they don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing in the sense that they know it's risky, but they don't know what they're... because they don't see how risky it is, because there is a general attitude amongst speculators, or else they wouldn't be speculators, that what goes up never comes down. There's a general attitude. Or if it does go down, that's for those other suckers. This is a general attitude. Or else you can't explain the bubbles that pop. You can't explain the 1929 crash. You can't explain the 90s crash. You can't explain any crash, except in the sense that there is a kind of foolish optimism on the part of the people who are involved, including the professionals, incidentally. Although the professionals are themselves knowing what I say, they know that most people are going to stick in there till it's too late, and they think they're smarter than most people, so they're going to wait until just the right moment, and they're going to get out, okay? Don't panic, but panic first is their law. But only a couple people make the guess at the right moment. The other 80,000 don't make it, or the other 80 million, or whatever it is. It's just craziness. Okay. Financial corporations' debt. This is something really, this is new. There's so many things that are new in the financial world. Hedge funds is something that's really the last 20 years or so. Now there's something else that's new in the last 20 years or so. Financial corporations' debt. That is to say, companies like Citigroup and so on and so on and so on. Citigroup, the biggest ones, all of them. I'll read this paragraph. The debt of Wall Street neither begins nor ends with banks and stockbrokers. To this complex net they have woven for themselves, one new element stands out as representative of their folly. It is called securitized lending. That's what they call it. The term refers to the lending activities of financial companies that, quote, spread the risk of lending by joining together on a given loan. We'll all go together when we go. Sounds sensible. However, in those same processes, such companies, all of them are lenders, have borrowed on the loans they have granted. I lend Jerry $50. And on that $50 I've loaned to him, I borrow another $50, or if I'm really smart, I'll borrow $500. I'll take a 10% on it, okay? 10% coverage. And I borrow that, and then I put it into something else that's an investment, a dangerous investment. They have borrowed on those loans that they are using these loans for collateral. What they have now, in 1989, they had $7 trillion of these things. Now, of course, it's much bigger than that. It exceeds the total amount of all household debt in the United States. It's double the amount of non-financial corporate debt. They are every. You can't look anywhere except maybe some little company down the street. You can't look anywhere that everything, the company, this, that, the other company, is up like this. And now we turn to foreign debt. That is to say, the debt of the United States to other countries. We were a borrower all the time during the 19th century, as we borrowed in order to industrialize, among other things, mostly to industrialize. We ceased to be a borrower during World War I because of the needs, especially of the British, during World War I. We became a creditor country. We stayed a creditor country. Except for a moment now and again, screwball moment, we were a creditor country until up through the 60s and the 70s. By the time we get to 1980, and your friend and mine, Ronald Reagan, becomes president, the United States was owed $1 trillion by the rest of the world. We had been lending to them as they were trying to recover from World War II and so on and so on, and as they were industrializing more, modernizing and so on. They owed us $1 trillion. Now we owe them $3 trillion. We had a very strong dollar. Reagan said, the stronger the dollar is, the better it is. He wasn't a horse's ass. He was a donkey's ass. Reagan was as stupid as they come. I don't mean he wasn't clever. He was stupid. He was ignorant, like Bush. Bush is clever, the way a rat is clever. But he's stupid, and he's ignorant. And his ignorance is matched by his arrogance and his confidence in himself and so on. Reagan was the same way, except Reagan, whom I despise, was lovable compared to Bush as a person. Because Reagan was a brute, often a brute, but not always. Bush is always a brute. We should be marching around with signs on our chest saying, I'm ashamed of you, Mr. Bush. Kill yourself. I don't believe in killing anybody. I wouldn't kill Bush. If he stood right here and I had a knife, I'd say, George, I can't do it. You do it. I have nothing against suicide at all. But Reagan, I never wanted to see Reagan kill himself. There was something about him that was sort of, well, okay. Maybe because he was once poor or something like that. Maybe because he had some kind of humanity to him. He had a sense of humor that was actually his own sense of humor, where Bush, everything is written for Bush, and it's never, ever funny. So now we have this enormous debt, and it must rise at an always increasing rate. I've said this before. You have to get this stuck in your head. We have this enormous debt. It and all the debts that we have, except the government debt to itself, all must rise. The household debt must rise. The foreign debt must rise. The corporation's debts must rise. Because the only way the economy will expand, or to put it differently, keep from contracting, is if it expands. And it can't expand except by further debt, increasing debt. And our foreign debt now is rising at the rate of more than $500 billion a year. It's going over $600 billion every year now. Okay? Must rise. It must. And it's held. The largest part of it is held by four Asian countries in that order. Four, they're the top four. Japan, China, South Korea, Taiwan. Then the rest of the world. Unless we keep borrowing, unless they keep lending, we can no longer buy their exports. If we no longer buy their exports, their economies get even saggier than they are, except for the Chinese and the Indians. Those are the only two really healthy economies in the world, if healthy is what they are.